Today is Tuesday, February 20th. We're going to start blood vessels, blood pressure, and blood pressure regulation today. Okay, so from page 51, we're going to talk about some general blood vessel structure information. So most of our blood vessels are made the same way. Most of our blood vessels have around three layers. They call the layers tunicas. Every time I hear that word, I want to say tuna, but it's not tuna. It's tunicas, it's layers. And so most of our vessels have these three tunics. There is an outermost layer that they call tunica adventitia or externum. There is an innermost layer called tunica media, or rather middle layer, and then the innermost layer is that tunica intima. Let's see, on your worksheet, I've got you starting off with tunica intima, so we'll actually start there with some details. Intima, what does that make you think of? It's the most innermost, right? Okay, so intima is the innermost layer. It is the one that comes in intimate contact with the blood flowing through your vessels. Now, tunica intima is also known as endothelium, and it is the same as the endocardium tissue that lines the inside of your heart. So that happens to be simple squamous epithelial tissue, and the simple squamous lining your heart is the same as the simple squamous lining the inside of your blood vessels. All right, what does media say to you?
Middle,
good. And there is smooth muscle that's found here. There are some elastic fibers found here, and it varies from arteries to veins. So depending on the function of the vessel, we may have more smooth muscle or less, more elastic fibers or less. I should also tell you that the tunica media has a nerve supply. It has a nerve supply coming from your autonomic nervous system. And that, of course, is the sympathetic branch. So what neurotransmitters are released by your sympathetic branch?
Epinephrine
and norepinephrine. So what impact do you think they will have on your vessel's diameter?
Constricted,
right. So if you are under the effects of the sympathetic nervous system, then we will vasoconstrict those vessels. And what do you think that will do to our blood pressure? Yeah, raise it up, good. So we can control vessel diameter through the sympathetic nervous system and epinephrine and norepinephrine. I should tell you, and I'll say this many times in this chapter, there's actually no parasympathetic innervation to your vessel media, tunica media. Okay, no parasympathetic innervation here. Okay, no parasympathetic innervation.
That's to tunica media?
That's to tunica media. Sure, there is no parasympathetic innervation to your vessel's tunica media. No parasympathetic innervation. No parasympathetic innervation to the vessel's tunica media. So if you're in fight or flight mode and you're experiencing, you know, excitement, emergency, you know, emotions, whatever it may be, and you're now experiencing epinephrine and norepinephrine, that tunica media can constrict, but there's no way to get it to directly relax. So since there's no parasympathetic innervation to your vessels, you basically have to stop doing what to them? You gotta stop constricting them, yeah. So you can either use sympathetic nervous system to constrict your vessels and increase blood pressure, or you can stop telling them to be constricted and you can eventually get them to relax. So it takes 30 minutes or longer for your vessel diameter to actually dilate when you stop stimulating them with sympathetic nervous system. It'd be really great if you had parasympathetic innervation, because you could say, hey, blood vessels, I'm relaxed now, and the vessel diameter would increase, and what would happen to your blood pressure? It'd decrease, yeah. But since there's no direct parasympathetic innervation to your vessels, you simply have to wait for the sympathetic innervation to go away. Basically stop that epinephrine and norepinephrine from being the squeezer on your blood vessels. Okay, so the outermost is your collagen fibers and your tunica externa or adventitia layer. How would you describe a collagen fiber?
Fibrous.
Strong but flexible, yeah. Steel-like, a little bit of stretch, not as much stretch as elastic fibers have. But if you're thinking about blood vessels that expand every time blood is pulsated through, you don't want those vessels to do what?
Bust,
yeah. So these are like steel cables that wrap the outsides of your vessels. They try to keep them intact and keep them from expanding and becoming too flabby. So once again, we've got to deal with that flabby issue that comes from overstretching the muscle layer in this vessel. Okay, so we talked about the term vasoconstriction. That is thanks to sympathetic innervation and epinephrine and norepinephrine. How do you get your vessels to dilate? Can you do so using the parasympathetic nervous system?
No.
So you have to just wait till sympathetic stimulation goes away. Yeah. So yeah, you gotta stop stimulating them and eventually they'll relax. So that means if you're really stressed out and you know you say, okay, I'm gonna breathe this off, I'm gonna shake this feeling, it's not an immediate relaxation. It takes like 30 minutes or longer for those vessels to finally dilate. So that's why if you're really worked up over something, your blood pressure is going to stay elevated for quite some time afterwards. So I know it's after Valentine's Day, but we've heard the poem before. Roses are red and violets are blue. Arteries are red, veins are blue. In the heart, there's an exception of two, right? Okay, so of course we flip-flop those in the heart, those pulmonary arteries and pulmonary veins. But elsewhere in the body, on those models, we color arteries red and veins as blue. What does the red indicate?
Oxygenated blood.
Good. And normally the blue is deoxygenated. Normally, arteries carry blood away from the heart, A for arteries and A for away. And of course, the exception is in the kidneys. We'll talk about that later on. Why do you think arteries need to have a thicker tunica medium?
More pressure.
They got more pressure, right? So they're coming off the heart with high pressure blood, and they need to be able to either stretch and control the volume of blood traveling through or constrict and perhaps limit the blood flow to a particular area. All right, so that's basically the story for the arteries. There are, in fact, two different kinds of arteries. There are elastic arteries and there are muscular arteries. I'll pause here in case you want a picture of this, or if you'd like to jot down some notes. Okay, so there are elastic arteries and there's muscular arteries. Elastic arteries, as the name implies, are stretchy. And these are the ones that are closest to the heart. Therefore, they experience the highest pressure. So aorta, of course, comes off with a pressure of about 120 millimeters mercury during ventricular systole. So we need it for that vessel to be able to expand. And then we also need it to be able to recoil back to its original shape. And we're able to accomplish that by having elastin fibers in the walls or the tunica media of that elastic aorta. So your aorta is actually about the size of your thumb. That's a pretty large vessel in your body. And you know, you've got to have it be able to recoil back. In people who have aortic aneurysms, that vessel can be three times or larger than the width of your thumb. So, you know, you're looking at an aorta that can be eventually this big if you lose the recoilability of that vessel. My dad had, several years ago, had vomiting that would not go away. And when they went into the hospital, they scanned to see if he had any digestive issues. Turns out he just had a stomach bug. But, you know, what they did notice was, ooh, that aorta is no longer thumb width. It's about three times that. And so just happened to notice that he had an aortic aneurysm in the abdomen. He was a smoker for many years, had high blood pressure for many years, had suffered several heart attacks. And there you go. Aortic aneurysm had to be repaired because you can bleed out in under 5 minutes if that ruptures. So, yeah, you got to have the recoil ability to get that vessel back to its normal shape. So these are what we call conducting arteries. Notice that all of these here, pulmonary trunk, aorta, common carotid, and subclavian, where are they close to? Close to your heart, right. And they're under what type of pressure?
High pressure.
High pressure, right. So these are the ones that are close to the heart. They're experiencing high pressure, and they're going to experience a great deal of stretch, and that's where we need the elasticity in those vessels. Now, by contrast, muscular arteries are, as they imply, they have a lot of smooth muscle and less elasticity. Here is where we can control the vessel diameter. So thinking back to Bio-210, neurotransmitters tell muscle cells to constrict or contract. We can't tell elastic fibers to contract. We just have to rely on their goodness, their elasticity to be able to recoil back. But we can tell smooth muscle using, you know, neurotransmitters, hey, we want you to contract. In fact, which nervous system branch do you think tells those vessels to contract? Sympathetic, yeah. So sympathetic can actually tell those muscular arteries to contract if needed. So these particular vessels go to a particular destination. They're named for the destination. So, you know, femoral tells me it's in the leg. Radial in the arm. We can keep listing arteries, and those that are typically named for a location most likely fall under the muscular category. We often find that we can feel a pulse in these vessels. That's because we get the force of systolic pressure alternating with the lesser force of what? Diastolic, right. So you get the strong push of systolic alternating with the lesser push of diastolic. And so as you continue getting further from the heart, that alternating force is going to start to be just a steady stream of blood flow. So we know that we can get pulses in certain locations around the body. What are some good places that you can take a pulse? So wrist is one, under your arm is one, in your neck, good. Behind your knee, good. Top of your foot. Let's see, you can actually get one at the base of your heart's apex. That's an apical pulse. You shouldn't use your thumb though, right? Because it has a pulse, good. And if you ever have trouble detecting pulse with two fingers, try the three-finger approach. I'm on a beta blocker. I think I may have mentioned that to you. Beta blockers block epinephrine and norepinephrine, so it lowers your heart rate and your blood pressure. And so if you are on a beta blocker, your contractility, that force, that push behind that blood is going to be less. So if you use the three-finger approach, use your ring finger to push down the vessel and block the blood flow through that vessel. And then gently use these first two fingers to lay on top. And then you'll feel the turbulation of the blood as it tries to make its way through that vessel. And now you can feel a pulse. So that may work for patients who have, say, a hard-to-detect pulse. So these elastic arteries have a lot of squiggly elastic fibers in them. You can see those here. Another nice look at some elastic arteries. By contrast, you'll notice less of those squiggly elastic fibers in this muscular artery. Basically, that's all you're looking at is muscle tissue in this vessel. And for comparison, you've got an elastic artery at top. You see all the squiggly elastic fibers. And you'll see more muscle tissue and less elastic fibers in the picture on the bottom. So both have thick tunica medias. It just may depend on where they're located and what they're doing. Okay, how about questions on arteries? Do you know what tiny arteries are called?
Arterioles.
Arterioles, good. Okay, And then, of course, we've got veins next. Why are they normally colored blue? Deoxygenated blood, right? That means it's low in oxygen, and most of our veins carry blood back to the heart. Good. Most of our veins have a thinner tunica media. What does that mean? Lower pressure. Good. So they've got lower pressure, therefore they don't need as much muscle tissue or elastic tissue to help stretch or, you know, recoil back. All right, so we know the exceptions once again are the two pulmonary veins on each side of the heart. Those bring blood back in from where? The lungs, good. And why are they colored red?
Because
oxygenated blood, good. So that's an unusual setup here. Okay, so since veins have very low pressure, and since gravity is working against us by pulling our blood down toward our feet, we need some things that assist us with the return of blood back to the heart. So in the larger veins, you have what? Valves. Good. The name of the game with a valve is to prevent what?
Backflow.
Good. We also have skeletal muscles that surround our veins. And every time you have blood pumped through a vein through skeletal muscle activity, then we've got that valve that shuts behind it and says, not so fast, you're not going to backflow on us. And that valve should prevent the pooling of blood in our extremities. So, you know, you may notice that I hardly ever stand still up here. I'm shifting because I like to see you guys in the back. And also, if I stand still and lock my knees, I'm more likely to do what?
Pass out.
So I know that a lot of you are going to do careers where you spend 10, 12 hours a day standing on your feet. And so we know that if you lock your knees, you don't let that blood come from those extremities back to the heart. All right, so here's some pictures of some valves. They're kind of like semilunar valves. They only open when blood forces against them, and then they should close right behind after the blood has passed through. All right, so there's a picture of a vein with its valve inside, another vein with a valve. And you can see that the walls here are actually really thin, so we don't have a lot of ability to contract around that blood and push it back to the heart. We're kind of relying on your movements to get that blood to flow back to the heart. So people who undergo surgery and then are left laying stationary in a hospital bed have a risk for what?
Blood clots.
Blood clots, good. So how do these compression or pneumatic boots help them? Keep the blood flowing, right. So basically what those do is the same thing that your skeletal muscles do. They squeeze those vessels, making sure the blood flows back to your heart. We don't want it to pool and clot there in the extremities. So I wanted to show you some pictures of problematic valves. If you happen to have valves that fail, we call them varicose veins. They can be rather painful, like in this picture. You might see what looks almost like a worm under the skin. They can inject some solution into those veins nowadays, and that can cause the vein to collapse and prevent it from being a place for blood to pool. So you can see they've actually done that. You no longer see that worm-like vein on the right side. Even hemorrhoids are varicose veins. If we strain to produce a bowel movement, that can cause the valves in our veins in the rectal area to fail, and then they can bleed because the blood is pooling in those veins. So here's one more reason not to strain when you produce a bowel movement. Pass out. All right, now I got bleeding. So besides having, you know, bowel movements producing varicose veins, other things that can induce varicose veins elsewhere in your body are things like obesity, pregnancy, working a job where you're picking up heavy stuff all the time. Those can cause a lot of pressure in those veins and cause those valves to fail. All right, so let's go back to our list. All right, so what do valves prevent from happening?
Backflow.
What does skeletal muscle activity do to the blood in your veins?
Push it through.
Push it through, good. And the third thing there that helps to get blood back to your heart is breathing. So if you've ever been really upset, I'm sure somebody has said to you, take a deep breath and calm down. What are they trying to do to you? Relax you, right? Get the heart rate to reduce, the blood pressure to reduce, And we know that blood flows from high pressure to low pressure. And if you take a deep breath, you're creating a lower pressure in your chest cavity. Therefore, blood travels from the higher pressure in your legs to the lower pressure in your chest. So by taking a deep breath and relaxing, you're actually helping to pull that blood back up to your chest. So those are actually three ways to help return not just blood in your veins, but also the lymphatic fluids that are out in your cells, out in the tissue spaces, back to your heart as well. So I'll repeat this list probably on Thursday when we talk about how do you get lymph back to the heart. That sounds like a good essay question, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, so you may want to mark that stuff down there at the bottom of page 51 for a potential essay question. Say that again. Yeah, with valves, with respiratory pump and muscular pump. Yeah, down at the very bottom. Those three things would be how you get blood in the veins back to the heart. Just for the sake of comparison, we can see an artery with a thicker tunica media on the right. Looks like it's a muscular one. I don't see too many elastic fibers over there. And by comparison, a much thinner walled vein here on the left. You can even see blood cells passing through. And another artery compared to a vein, much thicker wall for that artery on the left. And we also have smaller arteries called arterioles. They are just smaller in diameter than your typical artery. And they too have some muscular tissue that can constrict or contract, that can limit or increase whatever we need, blood flow to a particular area. So now let's flip over to page 52 and talk about capillaries. All right, very top of the page there, the only tunica that forms a capillary is which one? Intima, good. Tunica intima is all we've got. These capillaries are so tiny that blood cells have to travel through single file. This is a pretty neat picture of them traveling through a capillary in between some skeletal muscle tissue. And that's why those red blood cells have to be flexible. Sometimes they have to flex in on themselves to be able to fit through those capillaries. Most of our body cells and tissues are not far from a set of capillaries. There's a few exceptions. You know, we've got some avascular tissues like, you know, what, cartilage doesn't have a good blood supply. So there's a few exceptions, but most of our body cells and tissues have a pretty good blood supply, picking up oxygen and nutrients, dumping off waste products into this capillary. I also wanted to mention that capillaries don't exactly exist as a straight line connecting an arteriole to a venule. They more exist in what's called a capillary network or a capillary bed. So this is what you've got. You've got an arteriole on the left. This is a capillary bed here where we can do all sorts of exchanges. And then on the right, we've got a venule that's going to take that blood back to the heart. Yeah. So the capillary network is in more reality of what we've got than just a straight line connector between an arteriole and a venule. And in fact, there are sphincters here that can shut off blood supply through a capillary network and just make it a one-line connector through if need be. Or those sphincters can open and let the entire capillary network fill up with blood. So thinking back to Bio-210, what temperature that I could apply to your skin would make your sphincters close on your capillary networks? Cold, yeah. And of course, warm temperatures would open up those sphincters and increase the blood flow through. Some capillaries are different from others. Some capillaries have holes in them or pores. We call them fenestrations. The one on the right has openings between the cells in that tunica intima. What does that allow us to do with the surrounding cells and tissues? If you've got holes or pores in your capillaries, what does that allow you to do?
Exchange.
Yep. So if you want to do an exchange, this is a great way to do it, is do it with fenestrated capillaries. Capillaries in your liver are fenestrated because a lot of what we're doing there is exchanging with the liver. The spleen is also a good location for fenestrated capillaries. Now, there are some locations in your body where you don't need those fenestrations, and instead you actually don't want to perform many exchanges. So we may have what's called a closed or a continuous capillary, and we actually don't allow for exchanges. We've got tight junctions here that prevent any exchange with the environment. You probably learned about one of these back in Bio 210 in the brain. Blood-brain barrier. Good. So that is an example of a closed capillary network. Okay. So we kind of see that there's not all capillary networks are created the same.
So this one has gap junctions?
Perhaps gap junctions, or maybe just pores between the two. Okay. So there's a good deal of exchange that can occur.
You said the blood-brain barrier was a closed capillary?
It is a great example of a closed capillary. So in the middle of your page there, you've got just a blood flow recap. Now we can appreciate that arteries feed into smaller vessels called arterioles. Arterioles feed into capillaries. Now capillaries do the exchange, and then we return that blood back to venules and then to larger veins. So we've got that same setup for the pulmonary flow, and we've got that same setup for the systemic flow. So just wanted to recap, you've got that there in the middle of your page. Do you have any questions so far on basic blood vessel anatomy? Okay, so I'd like to turn our attention now to talking about blood pressure, because you know that's certainly something that blood vessels are helping us maintain. So down there at the bottom of your page, let's define the word blood pressure. And this is the force that blood exerts against the walls of your vessels. You could say that blood pressure is pushing against the walls of your vessels. And if you have high blood pressure, it's going to force even harder against the walls of those blood vessels. Thinking back to what we talked about earlier, which chamber of the heart is creating that force for systemic flow? Left ventricle, yes. So how hard that ventricle pumps is the force that you have behind the blood that's in circulation. We measure blood pressure in millimeters mercury. That's mmHg. And, you know, now that we've got these newfangled, you know, blood pressure machines, we don't have to necessarily have, you know, mercury in there. But back in the day, that is how high a column of mercury would be raised by the pressure exerted by a vessel. Okay, so we know that blood flows from high to low pressure. The highest pressure is going to be coming off the heart with that aorta. During systolic pressure, we know that pressure is around 120 millimeters mercury. During diastolic pressure, we fall to what? 80, yeah. So 120-ish over 80 or so is going to be left side systolic over diastolic pressure. And so we expect to see blood to flow through our vessels from high pressure in the arteries to the very lowest pressure in our veins. I've got this picture on your course pack. That's on page 53. You're going to want to flip back and forth between 52 and 53 for just a moment. So just to kind of explore this graph, what we're looking at is blood pressure in the vessels. And on the left-hand side, on the y-axis, we are looking at pressure in terms of millimeter mercury. I know you guys have talked about mean arterial pressure in lab, and that's what this line running through here represents. You'll notice it in the aorta, the elastic and muscular arteries, and even to some extent in the arterioles, you get a pulsation between systolic pressure, which is the higher number, and the lower number, which is diastolic pressure. But we know that the overall mean arterial pressure runs about through the middle of those two pulsating pressures. So of these vessels, the one to experience the highest pressure is, of course, the aorta. It comes off the left ventricle, and that is a blank for you down there on the bottom of page 52. Okay, the vessel experiencing the highest blood pressure is the aorta. You'll notice that we have a slight drop off through the elastic and muscular arteries. But then when you hit the arterioles, we take a big old nosedive way down in terms of pressure. So what just happened when you got to the arterioles? Why such a steep drop off? They're tinier, right? And you're getting less pressure, right? And so the heart's saying, hey, I beat just this hard. I beat 120 over 80. I can't beat any harder. And so the heart's pressure is going to start to diminish because you're getting farther from the heart and your vessel diameter is starting to shrink. So on your worksheet, bottom of 52, the steepest drop in blood pressure that occurs in your arterioles. Steepest drop occurs in your arterioles. Let's talk about your capillaries. They are the site of exchanges. We do fluid exchanges there. We do gas exchanges, nutrients, and waste products. If you want to exchange something, you've got to do it through those thin-walled capillaries. Arteries and veins are still too thick-walled for exchanges. We've got to do that kind of exchange in the capillary. So you'll notice the pressure when we come into a capillary is actually in the mid-30s. And we do drop off in pressure. We actually leave a capillary somewhere in the upper teens. But there is still pressure there to allow for exchanges to occur in the capillaries. Venules and the veins continue to see a decline in pressure. And by the time you reach your vena cava, you're looking at zero pressure or perhaps even negative pressure. So we've got three ways to assist getting that blood back to the heart in a vein. What's one of them?
Breathing,
valves,
muscular
contractions, right. So there's got to be some way to get blood back from your feet to your heart when you've got no pressure behind that blood flow. Okay, so the take-home message about this graph is you've got the highest pressure in the aorta, you've got the biggest drop-off in your arterioles, and then by the time you reach your veins and vena cava, you're looking at close to zero pressure. So we've been here before. Just want to re-mention this again. We've talked about it back a couple of pages ago. We know that normal blood pressure, systolic, is somewhere around 110 to 120. Normal diastolic pressure for the left side is about what? 70 to 80, okay? And we know that there's low numbers below 80 over 60, and there's high numbers when we're getting to like 140 over 90, then we're starting into the hypertension range. So the problem with low blood pressure is lack of delivery of what?
Oxygenated
blood, right. And the problem with high blood pressure is doing what to your vessels? Yeah, stretching them out. So the more force you have pushing against the walls, the more you stretch them out. And those elastic arteries, well, they only stretch so much, like underwear, right? You stretch them, and eventually they cannot recoil back to their original shape. Okay? All right, so it looks like we're ready for the information below your picture there. That's page 53. I believe it was last week we talked about cardiac output. I just want to repeat that one more time. Cardiac output is about how many liters of blood?
Five.
About five, good. Cardiac output depends on two things, heart rate and stroke volume. Heart rate at rest is normally about how many beats per minute? 75, good. And how about stroke volume for each ventricle? A little lower than 120? 70, yeah. So if you multiply the two, you're going to get a little higher than 5 liters, but on average, we're looking at about 5 liters of blood in circulation. We know these numbers are dependent upon each other. That means if heart rate increases and stroke volume increases, what happens to cardiac output? It increases too. Good. So we'll hang on to that thought, and now we're going to talk about this equation here. BP is blood pressure, and it depends on cardiac output, that's CO, and that's not Puerto Rico. What's PR? Yeah, peripheral resistance. It's a mouthful, right? Okay. Let me go ahead and tell you this. The number one determinant of your blood pressure is cardiac output. Okay, cardiac output is the main determinant of your blood pressure. If you get up and you feel a little lightheaded, the easiest way to increase your blood pressure is to do what? So if you get up and you feel a little bit lightheaded, the easiest way to increase your blood pressure is to drink. Drink. Because if you drink fluids, what happens to your cardiac output? Increase it, right. Likewise, if you have a patient that has chronic high blood pressure, the easiest way to lower the blood pressure is to do what?
Put them on a diuretic.
Put them on a diuretic, right. So do something that lowers the cardiac output. Diuretics will do that. Blocker drugs like alphas and betas will do that. So do something to lower the cardiac output. So basically, the blood volume that you transport is the number one determinant of your blood pressure. So things like anemia, polycythemia, dehydration, overhydration all can influence how much blood you transport. But that is the number one influence. Resistance is certainly important, but it's not the number one influence over your blood pressure. We're going to talk about these three factors here that provide resistance to blood flow. Okay, so let's talk first about blood viscosity. Okay, so viscosity means thickness. And if you're looking at transporting really thick blood, what does your heart have to do to push that thick blood through your vessels? Pump harder. And by nature, if your heart rate goes up, what happens to your pressure?
It goes up.
So which of these conditions do you think would cause you to have a higher heart rate and a higher blood pressure? Polycythemia, right. So the thicker your blood, the more we're looking at things like either dehydration or polycythemia. So I kind of equate this to milkshakes. You know, if you buy a milkshake that's incredibly thick, or if you make one yourself, the thicker it is, the harder you're working to pour that through a straw, right? Okay. What about a really thin milkshake? Do you have to work hard for it?
No.
So that means that the thickness is not there, and your heart's not working very hard, and your blood pressure's also lower, right? So let's think about the opposite condition to polycythemia. Polycythemia is too many blood cells, makes your blood thick. Anemia, good. So the opposite condition would be anemia, which means your blood actually would be less viscous, and you would actually have lower blood pressure and lower heart rate for it. So there's other factors there we haven't talked about yet with oxygen transport. We'll come back to that. Right now we're just focusing on the thickness of the blood. Okay, so blood thickness is one thing that provides resistance to flow. Another thing that provides resistance to flow is the length of your vessels. So imagine again that you had the perfect thickness milkshake. I'm gonna be hungry after this class. Okay. So if you had the perfect thickness milkshake, and you had the option of having this nice garden hose to drink your milkshake, or you perhaps had a drinking straw, what would you pick?
Straw.
You don't want my nice big garden hose?
Takes
longer, right? So even with the bigger diameter, you're still going to be sucking away on that garden hose while somebody else is long done with their milkshake, right? So the shorter the vessel, the easier it is to get the blood to flow through. What does the longer vessel do to the blood? It increases blood pressure and it increases resistance to the flow. Yeah. So, you know, when we think about weight, you know, how much weight we carry on our bodies, the more tissues you have to serve, the more blood vessels you have to serve those tissues. So that's why they say losing weight can actually lower your blood pressure. If you lose weight, you lose these vessels that then have to serve that tissue. So there's some thought behind losing weight and losing the mileage of tissues and the vessels that serve them. So that decreases your resistance to the blood flow. If you decrease the resistance, let's go back to our equation here. Decrease the resistance, what happens to your blood pressure? It also lowers down, exactly. All right, and there's one more thing that we can think about that contributes to blood pressure, and that is vessel diameter. So vessels can relax, vessels can constrict. Which scenario would cause you to have an increased blood pressure? Vasoconstriction. Why would that one make it harder for blood to get to your destinations?
Smaller
diameter. Good. And if you want more blood to make it to your destination more easily,
dilate
it, right? So increase the diameter, relax the blood vessels. Now, here's the catch. This is the only thing you can control over the short-term time. That's the only thing. You cannot control your viscosity right this minute. You cannot control your vessel length right this minute. But whether or not you're sitting or standing actually controls your vessel diameter. So, what nervous system branch innervates your vessels?
Sympathetic.
Good. Do you have parasympathetic innervation here?
No.
So, we can either tell your vessels to constrict by zapping them with epinephrine and norepinephrine, or we can stop stimulating them with epinephrine and norepinephrine, and then what happens?
They'll slowly
dilate and relax, right. So you can't just say, hey, vessels relax by giving them acetylcholine. We're not wired that way. So you have to wait like 30 minutes or longer for the relaxation to come. So this again is like drinking a milkshake through either a teeny tiny coffee stir versus through a big milkshake straw. You know, you want to be able to move blood more easily by dilating those vessels. Constricted vessels makes it harder for the blood to move through. Okay, so since this is the only thing you can control right now, there is a place in your brain called the vasomotor center that will control your vessel diameter. And it does so based on feedback.
Are we on page 54?
We are on page 54. So there's a lot of different things that influence your blood pressure. Right now we're talking about one that your brain can control. Your brain has a medulla oblongata, and you may recall from Bio 210, it has four regulatory centers. It has a vomiting center, it has a heart rate center, it also has a vasomotor center, excuse me, which we're talking about right now, and it also has a respiratory center, which we'll do later. So that medulla oblongata is kind of a sensor or a monitor for what's going on in your body in terms of blood pressure. And it can tell your vessels to constrict if need be, or it can stop telling them to constrict if necessary. So just as a reminder, I'm going to say this again, there's no parasympathetic innervation to your vessels, just sympathetic innervation. So which neurotransmitters communicate with your vessel's tunica media?
The norepinephrine.
Good, yeah, norepinephrine and epinephrine, good. So if you need to constrict your vessels, the vasomotor center can tell your vessels to constrict. Well, what if you want your vessels to dilate?
Stop.
Yes, stop stimulating them with epinephrine and norepinephrine. Can you directly tell your blood vessels to relax?
No.
You can't. You just have to wait for
30 minutes.
30 minutes, yeah. Wait for the epinephrine and norepinephrine to get cleared out of your system by your liver. Okay. Just checking to see if anybody still needs the slide. All good. Okay, so how does your brain know that you've got blood pressure problems? Good. The medulla, right?
Right.
So it's the one that says, oh, I'm getting the message that there's problems in the body. So in order for your brain to know that there's blood pressure issues, then we have to have tattletales set up somewhere in your body. So you can actually override your vasomotor center yourself. You know, I could say, hey, everybody, let's hyperventilate and pass out. We could certainly do it. We could all breathe, you know, so fast that we eventually make our blood too alkaline. We're not going to go there, but, you know, your brain can override your vasomotor center's control of blood pressure and heart rate. These two tattletales, though, we have no control over. These tattletales are receptors that sit in your aortic arch and your common carotid arteries. So why put tattletale receptors in those two locations? They're close to the brain, right? If you've got changes that are heading to the brain, you need to know about it. So we've got chemoreceptors that detect chemical changes. We've got baroreceptors that detect blood pressure changes. And both of these receptors tattletale to your control center. And what's your control center for blood pressure? Medulla oblongata. Good. So if you've got oxygen levels that are out of whack, CO2 levels out of whack, or even blood pH levels that are out of whack, chemoreceptors tattletale to your medulla oblongata. Likewise, baroreceptors are looking at blood pressure, and they too will tattletale to your medulla oblongata. Okay, so when your medulla oblongata gets this information, it says, okay, I need to fix the vessel diameter by doing either this or that. Okay, so what I'd like to do is talk to you through some different scenarios, and then I'm going to let you work on page 55. There's about four practice problems there. What I'm going to do, instead of reading the chart on the bottom of the page to you, is work you through several examples. So I was listening to a news report the other day. There's these people who, you know, like to climb mountains, like Mount Everest, right? And Mount Everest is an insanely tall mountain with very little oxygen at the top. And a lot of people that try to climb that mountain too quickly get what's called altitude sickness. And altitude sickness makes you have lightheadedness, as you might expect. You know, people are nauseated, they don't feel very good, and the only way to stop the altitude sickness is to come back down the mountain. So to prepare for climbing tall mountains like Mount Everest, some people have these sleeping tents. They call them like altitude tents that they sleep in. And I thought, this is crazy. You know, who wants to sleep in this tent that deprives their brain of oxygen? So that's what they do. They get their bodies ready for a very low oxygen environment by sleeping in these little altitude tents. So out of all of these issues here, what is my problem if I sleep in a low oxygen environment? Oxygen levels will decrease. Okay, so now I've got a problem, right? I'm no longer at normal oxygen levels. What kind of tattletale? Who's going to pick up on this? Chemoreceptors. So where do those chemoreceptors sit? Good. Aorta and the common carotid arteries. Those chemoreceptors are going to tattletale back to what part of your brain? Medulla. Good. Medulla says, you're not getting enough oxygen. We need to do something about your heart rate and your blood pressure so you get enough oxygen to the brain. So what do you think the response of your medulla is?
Increase.
Increase, yeah. Why do you want to increase the heart rate and the blood pressure? Circulate more oxygen through your bloodstream. Okay, so there's two things that we're going to do. We're going to increase sympathetic stimulation, because that's all we got, right? So how do you tell the heart to beat faster? Who's your number one in charge in the heart?
SA node.
So you tell the SA node, hey, here's some epinephrine or norepinephrine. We want you to do what?
Speed it up,
pump faster, get that blood circulation. So we're gonna tell that SA node, speed it up, and we're also gonna tell a certain portion of your vessel to constrict. What portion can constrict?
The
tunica
media.
Good. And what type of vessels do we tell this to? Arteries, arterioles?
Arteries.
And arterioles. Yeah, so we tell arteries and arterioles. Any parasympathetic stimulation, but the parasympathetic stimulation only goes to which of these? SA node, right? So we can actually decrease parasympathetic stimulation there. There's no effect of decreasing parasympathetic on the tunica media, right? Okay, so what do we see in terms of a response when we tell our SA node to increase sympathetic stimulation?
Heart rate faster.
Okay, so we increase heart rate. And what happens when we squeeze our tunica media?
Increase blood pressure.
We increase blood pressure. Good. So we're going to increase heart rate and we're going to increase blood pressure. So it's kind of a scary thought. You know, these people that do prep work for going to Mount Everest and they sleep in these altitude tents, and they have consistently deprived their brains of oxygen, they are basically telling their heart rate to increase and their blood pressure to increase, you know, in terms of making sure their brains get enough oxygen. Kind of a scary thing. Okay, let's do another one with this example. When we exercise, we breathe in oxygen, we use the oxygen and glucose to make ATP, and what is the waste product that we create?
CO2.
Good. So if you're exercising and you're producing a lot of excess CO2, these common carotid arteries and aortic arch have receptors that pick up on this. Is it a baroreceptor or a chemoreceptor?
Chemoreceptor.
So the chemoreceptor tattletales to where?
To
the medulla oblongata. And in response, the medulla says, hey, your CO2 levels are too high. Let's get rid of them. Let's do what to your heart rate and your blood pressure?
Increase.
Yeah. So we've got the same playback. We're going to do the same response. Increase sympathetic stimulation. Make your heart rate go up. Increase the constriction of your vessels. That means that your vessels are going to cause increases in blood pressure. Okay. Let's go to the other side down here. Let's talk about some other problems. Okay, so sometimes people have stomach aches and they take a bunch of antacids. And antacids are not harmless. They're like any other chemical in our bloodstream that can cause pH changes. Antacids are alkaline in nature. So guess what they do to your blood pH?
They raise it.
Right. So the higher your blood pH goes, the less hydrogens you've got in your bloodstream. So once again, we've got tattletales sitting in our common carotid arteries and our aortic arch that pick up on this blood pH change. So what kind of receptors pick up on this?
Chemoreceptors.
Chemoreceptors tattletale to your medulla, and the medulla says, blood pH is too alkaline. What should I do to fix this? Decrease sympathetic stimulation. And this time it's going to make a difference. We're going to increase what stimulation?
Parasympathetic.
The increased parasympathetic.
So this game faces because you're working too hard, so you're going to decrease that and you want to stay at rest.
Stay at rest, yeah. No. What's that?
I thought we couldn't control the parasympathetic.
There is parasympathetic to your heart. There's just no parasympathetic innervation to your vessels. So in this case, we're going to actually ramp up vagus nerve control and dump acetylcholine onto the SA node, and the SA node's going to slow down its rate. But yeah, you can release all the acetylcholine you want to in the vessels. They don't seem to respond to it like the heart does. All right, so decreasing sympathetic stimulation basically means we're getting rid of which two neurotransmitters?
Epinephrine and norepinephrine.
Epinephrine and norepinephrine. So what do you expect to see for your heart rate?
Decrease.
Heart rate decreases. And then because we are lowering, once again, the epinephrine, norepinephrine to your vessels will dilate and your decreased blood pressure. Good. So yeah, the catch is, and let's put a star beside this one here, parasympathetic stimulation. That's only for the heart. And just to repeat what we've studied a little bit earlier, what cranial nerve carries acetylcholine to the heart's SA node? Vagus nerve, good. So that parasympathetic stimulation is only going to the heart. So interesting, if people take, you know, antacids and they're hoping to get rid of a stomach ache, they may end up having their heart rate and their blood pressure fall very low, and they could ultimately do what? If your blood pressure is really low, you're gonna
pass out.
Yeah. So that's a danger of having, say, you know, taken too many of those antacids. You can do the same thing if you have frequent vomiting. You can remove so many hydrogens from your stomach that you can end up causing your blood pH to go high, and your heart rate and your blood pressure will go low. So it's what we're looking at is a compensation mechanism. Okay, let's do another one. Let's say you've had a lot of fluids over a short period of time. Okay, a lot of fluids over a short period of time have what influence over these things listed here?
Increase your blood pressure.
Increase your blood pressure. Because the number one determinant of blood pressure is
cardiac
output. Good. So if I drink a lot of fluids over a short period of time, I increase my cardiac output and my blood pressure. Now, which of the receptors detect this?
Baroreceptors.
Good. So the baroreceptors tattletale to your brain. Your brain says, hey, blood pressure is too high. We need to lower both blood pressure and heart rate. So what do?
Decrease
sympathetic and increase parasympathetic. Good. So the point I want to make here is, you know, the example I just used is I've got too many fluids. I didn't say I had any problem with my blood gases, right? So my oxygen, my CO2, my blood pH, they may all look perfectly fine. So the whole goal here of basically turning on this feedback mechanism is to make sure my blood pressure goes down. So it's not to fix an oxygen problem or a CO2 problem. I will only do this for those issues if that's what I want to fix. So I don't necessarily have to alter oxygen or CO2 if I'm fixing a blood pressure issue. So what I'd like to do is cut you loose with the four problems on the next page, let you work on those for a few minutes. And before you leave here today, I'd like to go back through those answers for you. So I know we only have a few minutes left. I'd like to hit at least a few of those answers with you. The first problem on page 55 is done for you with the high blood pressure feedback mechanism. Let's do the second one there. We've got a patient with, say, low blood pressure. He's dehydrated. So the stimuli are these things listed on the board: blood gas problems and blood pressure problems. So for this person who's dehydrated, what is his issue?
Blood pressure.
That's it, good. What kind of receptor picks up on blood pressure problems?
Receptor.
Good, good. And our control center is our medulla, and it says we should do what?
Increase
sympathetic, decrease parasympathetic. And the bottom line is, the effector is, what do we see? Good. SA node fires more quickly, your heart rate increases. And at the same time, you're also going to tell those blood vessels to constrict, and your blood pressure should increase. Good. Did you do okay with that one? Good. Okay. Let's see. The next one there is a high blood pH. That was the example we did. Too many alkaline acids. Well, the problem of the issues here is what?
Alkalosis.
Yeah, so that's too few hydrogens. That's alkalosis. Of course, we use what kind of receptor to pick up on this?
Chemoreceptor.
Good. The medulla, being our control center, says we should increase what kind of stimulation?
Parasympathetic.
And decrease?
Sympathetic.
Right. Keeping in mind that the only parasympathetic innervation is to the
heart.
Good. So in terms of the effectors, what happens to the speed of your SA nodes firing?
Slower.
Decrease it slower. Good. Heart rate will decrease as well. And by having less epinephrine and norepinephrine, what happens to our vessel diameter?
They'll dilate,
and blood pressure will
decrease.
Good. Do okay with that one? Did you get a chance to do hypercapnia? Not yet. Why don't you work on hypercapnia and hypoxia, and then we'll do the answers when we get back together on Thursday. Not a lot left in this chapter. We'll do bulk fluid transport on Thursday as well. That's a big topic on page 58 and 59.